Good evening from Winchester in the UK. My name is Andy Rice, and on the other side of the world with me is Hamish Wilcox in Auckland, New Zealand. Good morning, Hamish. It's Sunday morning for you.
Yes, and it's a rather a lot more pleasant time of day as well, an hour later. So the sun's up just, and I think we're in for a bit of a stormy day today.
Well, I want to come on to the weather and Mother Nature in a moment. I just also want to say thank you to Penny and Russ Clark for being our hosts this evening. Normally it's my son Benedict, but he's out on the town in Spain. So thank you very much to the Clarks for being our host behind the scenes. They're going to be helping me out with fielding questions and things like that. And that is a reminder to me to remind you that at any point, please go ahead and ask questions. Some people here will have completed all of The Road to Gold, all 12 chapters, but others will be very new to Road to Gold. But don't be afraid of asking questions. This is your big opportunity. And Hamish, let me kick off the way that we usually do. Tell me what life has been like in Auckland over the last few days. It's been the envy of the world, New Zealand, over the last number of months, the most desirable place in the world to live. But I haven't been entirely envious of you over the last couple of days. What's been going on?
Yeah, well, Mother Nature's definitely reared its head, and I quite like it, actually. So a bit different to others. I always enjoy seeing what she can do. And we've had a big earthquake the morning before popped up on our ring of fire, which is the Pacific plate running around or through New Zealand and then around the East Cape. And it's it got everybody running for the mountains. And it was around school time in Whakatane, when they were doing the drop off, and they had the alert come on their phone, and all the parents dropping their kids off were driving for the highest ground and spent the morning up on the mountain above town, eking out food from the school lunch boxes amongst themselves. And then as it went up further north, we ended up with a cluster of earthquakes in the Kermadec Islands, which is a New Zealand, small group of New Zealand islands, in fact, where they put the French bombers of the Rainbow Warrior back in the day. Those agents were put on that island because they're 500 miles from anywhere and left there for 3 or 4 years as punishment for bombing the Rainbow Warrior Greenpeace ship back in the 80s. But really remote, no one's living there now. But around that island, they ended up with a 8.1 magnitude earthquake, which set off a tsunami alert for the whole country, not just the East Cape. And I sent you a video, didn't I, of Tutukaka feeling the effects, and we were kept off the water until 4 o'clock that day.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about Tutukaka a number of times because you've been running or part of running wave camps there for the Olympic sailing team due to go to Tokyo and experience those massive waves that potentially you can get at the Olympic venue of Enoshima. But obviously that would have been a wave too far, that tsunami that swept into Tutukaka. How much damage was done on the coastline?
Well, Tutukaka's pretty set up for it. They've always had trouble in that marina with tsunamis, and they're not completely unusual. So they built the marina incredibly robustly, and you know, mooring lines are oversized and piles are much higher to cope with this kind of wave. And it didn't. Well, there's a friend of ours that does. He's a contender world champion. I should remember his name. Pete Newlands and anyway.
Oh, I know who was it. Wasn't Tony somebody? Was it
Tony Smith? He's got a boatyard up there at the very head. So I will give him a call today. I've been busy, but to see how he got on, because I'm sure he would have got a bit flooded. Because as that wave went up the harbour in that video, you would have. He's on that slipway at the end, so he would have definitely had a bit of an undulation in his end of the world. And yeah, it would have been quite full on if anyone wasn't prepared in the marina for that.
So the America's Cup was already postponed because of COVID. So if the COVID postponement hadn't have happened, what would the effect of Mother Nature have been on the running of the America's Cup, speculatively?
Well, we were kept off the water, so they had police boats in the harbour, making sure that, and they locked the marinas and making sure that no one went on the water or down by the coast. And they were just, they were pretty vigilant, and they stopped all the ferry services, and, you know, they pretty much shut the place down. And of course, you always get the people going down to the beach to have a look, and they swept the beach near my house here, Maringi Bay, around about 11 o'clock. They shooed off everybody. And we just waited till 4 o'clock, and they opened the waters at 4 o'clock, and then they released everybody around. They sort of let us into it, so we were prepared to go sailing at 4 o'clock. And I think the release came earlier, but we ended up docking out at 4 o'clock and getting a really good session on the back paddock.
Right, and give us the latest expectation of when you're likely to get racing and race one of the America's Cup match.
Well, this COVID thing allows us to keep sailing under this level three. We're currently shifted last night to level two, and it's likely that we'll go down the levels. Level two allows us to race. So level three, we thought we could get an exemption, but the ministry of whatever, they decided that we couldn't, because they've cancelled so many other sporting events that an exemption for the America's Cup would have been a bit of a slap in the face for all the other sporting events they've cancelled last week. So we ended up sitting it out, as you know, missing the first 2 days of racing. Yesterday would have been a glamour day. We were out sailing yesterday and looking at the watches, thinking we'd be facing our opposition for the first time instead of looking at them right next to us doing start drills. We were down on the back paddock in course area E, and it was a beautiful northerly, around 15 knots, just coming straight in through the gap between Motutapu and Waiheke. So really clean, very stable wind. Today, on the other hand, it's very calm right now, but we know that there's a big frontal system coming in, and it's 20 to 30 knots this afternoon forecasted. So we're not actually missing a day's racing today.
Okay. Now, one of the skills that we talk about on Road to Gold is keeping your head in the game when you're on postponement and you're sitting around all day. How do you think your team is benefiting, if it is benefiting, from the extra time? And who do you think is benefiting the most, New Zealand or Italy, from this delay?
Well, I think we've probably done a few more days on the water. I would say that they come off a period where they can make adjustments in the shed, so they've probably taken that approach. And for us, you know, our learning curve is still pretty vertical, to be honest. So every day you come back with, you know, a bunch of learnings. It's the most exciting part of a campaign, when you're still learning massively, and, you know, you're still climbing that learning curve. So everybody's loving it, and for that reason, you know, you come back with another huge progression. And it's for us just doing all the basics, you know. Just, I think Dean Barker called it the race trade, and quickly changed his mind when he realized that the America's Cup's typically won by the fastest boat, and will be again, but there's the low-hanging fruit, the easy gains right now for everybody, and just figuring out how to race the boat well in terms of entering the start line, you know, doing your manoeuvres really, really well in the pre-start area, managing to start with, you know, 120-130% VMG, just slingshot the thing out of there and then control the race. And so all those manoeuvres are a lot about controlling the race. You can lose a bad manoeuvre, can cost you 100 metres.
So one of the things that you preach on Road to Gold is don't go racing until you're ready to do well. The Olympic level, you don't like taking people until they're ready to finish in the top 10 of a major regatta. So that's the way that you approach it. With all that in mind, the America's Cup isn't really a regatta that you can approach in that organised way, because you just don't get the build-up. So how do you rate where you are compared with where you would be if you were doing the America's Cup with at least 4, if not 8 or 12 years of preparation.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think the road to gold still measures the gaps really well. And obviously the key thing in the America's Cup is, you know, selecting your equipment and designing it and making it. And those early decisions are probably going to be the foundation of this game as well. If you've got that wrong, you know, you'll be going home early because you're not going to be able to change that. It really is quite fixed. And, you know, the selection of the crew and the selection of the team and all those early chapters are still really, really important. But, you know, what typically happens next is that the boat speed development goes in place of the next chapters, which is, you know, your boat handling and your manoeuvres and things, because everybody's just focused on developing what they've designed for those next few years. The focus, as soon as the boat goes in the water, becomes how do we develop this tool as fast as we can and try to get it to its targets, you know, its design targets. So that tends to happen before all the manoeuvres and things, but you still have this measure in your mind of, you know, the complete picture. You know, including all the last minute, the last planning stages, and which are the final chapters. And obviously, we're into the racing now, and you still have to complete it as much as you can. You know, so we're in, you know, one of those days where you're swatting violently for an exam the next day. You know, where you're that's where everybody's at right now, just putting as much effort as they can into grabbing those things around manoeuvring.
I'm guessing there's still a lot on the list. You've all of you at Emirates Team New Zealand made a list of things that you'd like to get done, and you're just not going to get to the bottom of that tick list, are you?
Exactly. And it's fun. We're looking over at Lunarosa in the back paddock, and we can see that's exactly what they're doing too. You know, so it's not rocket science. I think they really feel they've got an advantage with. We think they feel they've got an advantage with their manoeuvres. They've gotten more racing in, so they're probably a little bit better prepared in terms of their communication about the other boat on the race course and reality and sort of a whole lot of those nuances of the race trade. They've had 17 races, I think, so, and we've had, you know, 4 or 5 in the Christmas Cup. So there's going to be a real catch-up for us.
And certainly Spithill and Bruni and the team have looked very strong in the pre-start compared with the challengers. And that's going to be, I mean, you talked about taking control of the race. The general sense seems to be that most people think that New Zealand is going to have the faster boat. If that's the way the Italians feel as well, then they're just going to be even more aggressive. We know how aggressive Jimmy Spithill can be.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's it's going to be some real key things around the pre-start to watch for. It's going to come down to how well these teams can manoeuvre their boats in the end, because you can have all the ideas in the world, but if you can't actually execute them, then, you know, you're going to fall off your foils and be looking pretty silly. And so that, you know, you've really got to be able to manoeuvre well to execute what you want to do in the pre-start. And, you know, whether it's, you know, whatever, you know. So I think it's going to be really interesting and really challenging and to see what actually happens there and who ends up coming out on top. And then, of course, it's all about the control. And we've seen Jimmy yesterday just doing, you know, 9 tacks as an example, a 1.7-mile beat. So, you know, he's ready for a match race. He's getting ready for a match race. And I think, you know, as we've heard him say over and over again, if he gets ahead, he's going to want to put his foot on the throat. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see exactly how the boats respond to that.
Yeah, absolutely. The coverage has been fantastic. And I want to know from a Road to Gold perspective, what you think Road to Goldsters, our students, should be paying most attention to? I mean, I'll throw one in. Listening to the communication, I think, is fascinating. There are great lessons there. But what other things would you want to sort of draw attention to that we can take back to our own racing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think knowing there's a lot around the rules, which is good. And all that stuff is online. You can have a look on the 36th America's Cup website and everything is in there. It's a bit of a mishmash finding your way to it, so have patience, but you'll find all the rules of the protocol, the class rules, and all that side of things. So if you really are, you know, fascinated by it, it's good to get ahead of the game and understand a little bit more about the rules they've worked out for these boats. And then you'll see as well that umpires have a booth. So they're not actually umpiring from the water. They're in a booth and they've got accuracy on the GPS, differential GPSs of the boats down to 2 centimetres, they reckon. So they're able to make calls, you know, in the booth far, far more accurately than they would have done on the water.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I hope that pretty much everyone here is watching and enjoying that. I'm sorry if we've gone on a little bit about the America's Cup. I've still got more questions, but we'll maybe come back to that a little bit later on, Hamish. Yaroslav has picked up on a theme that actually is quite common to some of the questions that have come through on email. And this goes to the heart of Road to Gold, of the fact that we really want you to focus on training. And if you can train in a squad, the stronger that you will be. But Yaroslav, if you want to come in and ask your question, you'd be very welcome. It's always nice to have people ask their question directly. So just let us know if you can come in. Otherwise, I'll ask it for you.
Hello.
Hi, Yaroslav. Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I apologize. I cannot turn on the camera.
Oh, well, never mind. Ask your question because it's a really, really good one that is central to Road to Gold.
Yeah, I mean, you said you should go to a major championship or a major regatta when you think you're ready to get to the top 10. So when do you know you can get to the top 10? And how do you recognize the right time to go racing?
That's a really good question. And it's a tricky one to answer because we were lucky enough, you know, when I think back at my own, that question directed at me, and I'm thinking, well, at the time it was, there was a measurable standard within the group of sailors in New Zealand. So we knew that if we could get ahead of them, we actually knew where we were. So if you haven't got that, then I think it's just looking objectively at your performance, and I'm really hoping that one day we're going to get a tool to measure it sort of in a visual way. But the idea is with Road to Gold is that we will do a little test. It'll be like a self-evaluation test where you measure yourself against the best you know, and in some cases that may have to be looking at video, you know, because you can find good online content around a lot of classes. And across those 12 chapters, within each chapter, there's going to be 5 pillars of learning. And within each of those pillars of learning, there's 3 win categories, you know, just simply light, medium, and strong. And the idea is that you'll do this test and you'll be able to evaluate your performance against the best you know, and then that'll show your gaps and really lift the bar to where you want to be in order to motivate your training and focus your training on lifting the bar to that, wherever you see that level ahead of you. So it's more about sort of dangling the carrots and looking up to where you want to go rather than critiquing where you are now. It's just more important to see where you need to get to, the level you need to get to, and then filling those gaps.
Well, the other thing that you've talked about, Hamish, is that if you sort of work your way up the let's say we're talking about the Olympic circuit, and you say, right, I'm just going to get on the road, and I know it's going to take me 10 years to get to the top of Gold Fleet, you're going to end up ingraining bad habits. And I think what Yaroslav and also Martin, who's dropped a question into the inbox as well, is there fear about ingraining bad habits? But at the same time, is it okay to go to a regatta to get a gauge of where you are, to be able to mark yourself on the test? Or are you, just by going to a regatta knowing that you're unprepared, are you setting yourself up for long-term failure?
No, I think it's a good question. I think, you know, learning to win is like I said, winning, actually. And if you can, you know, even moving around other classes, I've always thought it really, really valuable to sail in other classes for that reason. And we've encouraged it during this COVID period in New Zealand. We've gotten all our Olympic sailors out into as many other classes as they can. And and to challenge themselves, and then they're winning. They should be if they're good as they think they are. And you're not forgetting the skills required to win, and the whole concept of winning. And so I think it's really good to take yourself out into out of your depth and jump in the deep end. Obviously, you don't want to sink and drown, but if you can jump in the deep end at a big regatta and just go, okay, I know I'm not prepared, but I want to see where I need to get to. And a lot of time, I remember Viktor Kovalenko taking, and I've forgotten his name.
Tom King.
Yeah, it was Tom King. Out on the coach boat when Tom's crew was crook. And I remember talking to Tom about that Olympic campaign 2000. And he said that was a real turning point for him. He got off the, you know, he'd been one of those battlers that had been around 15 years in the class and never really fired a shot, gotten pretty good at a lot of things, but his race trade, I guess, was lacking, and his confidence and his decision-making. Anyway, he got on the coach boat with Viktor Kovalenko for that week of Europeans at Lake Garda, it was. And it was a turning point. He looked back, 2 years later or 18 months later when the gold medal was around his neck and we were having a chat to him, and he said that was a turning point. So you don't even really need to get in the boat and sail the regatta, but if you can get a real look at what's going on, even better from the coach boat sometimes.
Yeah, and in one of the chapters, it was one of the final chapters, we talk about Tom King in some detail in that one. And for me, his story is very inspiring, because his record in 470 World Championships in the lead up to Sydney, it went from about 45th in one World Championship. Next year it was 20th. Next year it was 10th. And the year after that, it was first. So he won the Worlds leading up to actually winning the Olympic regatta. And I remember when I was sailing in the 470, I was having a bad day if ever I was beaten by Tom King. He was a real journeyman. And the quote that I remember him saying after working with Viktor and working his way up the pecking order so rapidly was, "Viktor worked us so hard, we trained so hard until talent was no longer an issue." So that was his thing, is you remove the differentiating factor of other people being more talented than you if you work hard and you work smart. And I found that very inspiring, what Tom said.
Yeah.
Martin, you've dropped in the question, when you go to a major event and you're not ready, how can you make the most of it? We partially answered that, but you've emailed us some fantastic questions. If you would like to join us on the call and ask any of those questions directly, it would be great to hear from you directly. So just here we are. Hi, Martin.
Okay. Can folks you hear me?
Yes, there's quite a lot of background noise, but it sounds like you're at Super Bowl or something.
I'm having a great lunch here in the breeze in Miami. Hi, everyone. And so the key question here is, we have an event coming up. We're not ready. We're on a NACRA 15. We're really not ready. But there are no NACRA 15s here. There's not much of a U.S. fleet. Now, what there is of the U.S. fleet, we'll get together in about 2 months in Clearwater. We can drive there. It's not a big deal. And we'd love to join that race, although it's premature. We know it's premature, but we want to learn as much as we can. What should we do? What shouldn't we do?
Okay. Thanks for your question, Martin. Andy, you're back there. Yeah, I think answering it from my perspective is that you've got to evaluate your, I'd be first thinking about evaluating my budget. I'd not be thinking, I know those events are really costly. Is that the best way to spend my money? Have I got, so then you'd be looking across the board, and you need to do that with Road to Gold and decide where, as you always do, where the priorities are. And if that still fits in there, okay, then I would for sure, have a good, strong list of things to take with you to the event. And, one of them might be, walking around the dinghy park with your phone and getting a really good understanding by shooting photos of what everybody's doing, with their equipment and where their settings are. Are we still there, Andy?
Yeah, I've got you fine, Hamish. Yeah, we're going fine.
Yeah, so just have a good long list in your pocket of things you want to get from that event. Obviously, it's reconnaissance. You know, you're looking at what other people are doing. You're feeling by the sound of it like you're at the bottom of the food chain at the moment, and you want to move up. So you're just looking at gathering information. And then on the race course, you know, probably you just have to resign. Typically, when you're not fast enough, you have to resign yourself to being on the sides of the course and where people aren't. And the reason that people aren't there is because it's probably the wrong decision. And you know, getting off the start line is going to be a challenge. And, you know, you just have to get, expectations set correctly. There's no point in, you know, I think a lot of people will get a lot less out of a regatta if they haven't put their expectations in the right place. In your position. So yeah, getting your expectations right and really using it, as you say, to gather information and see where the bar is.
Great, thank you. And really good questions, Martin. One of your other questions, you bring up that Santiago Langer has recently published a book called Viento, and apparently he has some great anecdotes about buying a winning boat, buying a boat with a proven record, which is one of the other things we talk about on Road to Gold. Hamish, did you know that Santi had written a book?
Ah, that's fantastic. We should chase him up on that.
Yeah, we should. For those of us that weren't on that call, Santi Langer was one of our guests when we were talking about starting a few weeks ago. And we had some incredible insights there in just how out of fashion transits are, and I've wasted my whole life trying to get transits on a start line because apparently Santiago Langer doesn't. Anyway, it's interesting to hear about that. And Martin, I'll just ask you a question about what you say is, for those of us who are not gear tuning magicians, are there good budget tips to A, get your equipment in the performance ballpark, and B, validate that your equipment is in the ballpark so you can shift focus and move on?
So, I think that's real. Yeah, I think that shift focus and move on, you know, we hear that so often from other campaigns as well. It's something that I've preached, you know, even though we're always looking to develop, and we all get involved in that development circle or spiral, as it can be sometimes. It's, if you're starting up in a class, not a priority. And yes, you're totally right. And saying that if you can avoid it and focus your energies on other areas, then in the first instance, it's a really, really good thing to do. So yeah, it's just a matter of searching, and it's pretty cool how much information's out there. We keep saying that it's often even on the internet. You know, we had a laugh one day, we Googled tuning guides and it wasn't Andy and myself, and it was amazing how many tuning guides we found available on the internet for just, as an example, the 470. And when I looked at them, they're really, really good tuning guides. You know, they're not, you know, you'd be pretty happy to win an Olympic gold medal with one of those tuning guides. They're not, you know, they're not useless. They've got a lot of detail in them. So yeah, start by searching and researching.
And that reminds me what you've just said there, that Nigel Wakefield got in touch with me during the week to pass on a question to you. And it's about how he struggled to get off the start line in an RS100, which is a lightweight single hander with an asymmetric. But the asymmetric is neither here nor there. It's the fact that Nigel's used to starting with a jib to help pull the bow off. Anyway, I suggested that Nigel look for experts within the class, and he got in touch with Nick Craig, who's won a number of world championships in a range of classes, double handers and single handers, including the OK. And he contacted Nick Craig and immediately got, an hour or so later, some fantastic advice back from Nick Craig. So Hamish, just as there are great tuning guides out there, one of your other tips is, especially for local knowledge, ask people, but ask people about anything, because it's a very generous sport that we operate in, so make the most of it.
Totally.
By the way, Martin's follow-up, most of you will have read this, but Santi's anecdotes in his book are about winning with hand-me-down clapped out gear, so not necessarily what you recommend, Hamish, but you get extra brownie points if you can do that.
Exactly.
Now, Frank Huth, you've been one of our regulars. Frank, if you'd like to join us, you've got a fantastic question, and I'd like you to place it directly, but let me know if you can, and if you can't, I'll ask it for you. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you loud and clear, yeah. And it's a great question, so launch into it for us.
Yeah, thank you. I just have to find my questions, actually. Where was it?
Well, tell us the story. It's about your daughter.
I have a daughter. She is 12 years old now. And she is this year, next week, she's starting on her, we should say, first campaign in competing. And she's lucky because she has a really good trainer with Olympic experience. So he's really, really good. And for me as a father, this is a kind of new experience because now it's getting more serious. And she will start to train 3 or 4 days a week. And it's, well, I'm not quite sure if she understands what she signed up for. But she has fun and she likes sailing. And I think one of the challenges here is being actually a good father for my daughter in the sport. And I think being a good father when things are getting tough, when she's not in a mood, she don't want to go to training one day, for instance, and when she has setbacks on the race course. So... thinking about your own experience, Hamish, I would like to get your tips on how what you actually should do as a father in those situations.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question, and it's, as you say, a little bit of knowledge about the sport is actually makes it harder. You know, I felt for both my kids when they embarked on Olympic campaigns, and I was like, oh. You know, and I think the first thing for me was to realize that you don't want to really let on what it's the whole, you don't want to paint the whole picture. It's better to be taking one day at a time, really. I think certainly don't get too far ahead of yourself. It's easy knowing the road ahead, which you obviously do by the sound of it. It's easy to get ahead of yourself or ahead of themselves. So just keep it focused on the here and now, what's immediately in front, sort of one step at a time, and making it really a fun experience. So, you know, that you always bring it back to that whenever, through the highs and the lows, you know, that you just, okay, if you're not enjoying it, you know, so you stay in bed, you know, do something else, re-energize. And I often found that sort of certainly with my, yeah, with both kids a little bit, but certainly with my daughter, with her skiing thing is, you know, it was easy to use the reverse psychology, you know, hey, you're welcome to come back and, you know, start on your life, you know, it's whether that, you know, we always joked with her that we were going to help her out with some help with her university if she did get stuck in, but that help offer wasn't going to last forever while she was off going around the world doing her skiing thing. So yeah, there's lots of ways that you can bring it back. You know, look, you have a choice. Here's your choices. You can do this or you can do that, and you can bring it back and move on. But it isn't easy, and it's great that you can be supportive. And I know Russell Coutts, you know, when we talked about doing this Road to Gold thing at the very beginning, he said, you know, he was one of the guys that pushed me really hard to do it, because he said it was just so hard for him as a father of a budding sailor, his own son, to manage sort of all these different things without the sort of clear understanding about the sort of coaching side of things. So I think, helping your daughter is very honourable, and just, yeah, be in the background and push from behind.
And the temptation when you've got the kind of knowledge that you do, Hamish, of having won 3 470 world championships, especially with Daniel, even more so with Anna, Daniel being a 470 campaigner as he is, how did you sort of balance passing on that knowledge to him and giving him shortcuts without overwhelming him? In other words, how much do you have to let your kids stick their own finger in the fire?
Yeah, I'm definitely a big believer in that. I try not to get involved at all, you know, and this is a question coming from him to me. I've just always left him to it. And that goes right back, because remember, I've kind of been involved right from his Opti days. So right through his junior sailing, his youth sailing, and his Olympic sailing. And we sort of have a unspoken, you know, sort of way of doing things. And it's almost like I'm his last resort. You know, if he's exhausted all other, you know, all other means of finding out about something, he'll come and ask me, really. So it's a good attitude. You know, he's, you know, it's been his program, and it's as though, although I did coach him a little bit, it was always with trepidation.
Yeah, no, understandably so. But I think that trepidation that you talk about and that Frank is showing by asking the question is maybe the right place to start from. Because, I mean, the conversation we're having reminds me of what Ian Walker mentioned on a webinar I was on a couple of weeks ago. He had the perfect parents that were happy to drive him anywhere, but didn't know the first thing about rigging up a boat or which way up the track to go. So they were the delivery people to get him to the event. But from then on, he was on his own. And speaking from his position as director of racing at the RYA and having a flea in his ear every hour of the day by a parent who wants their kid to win an Olympic gold medal or something, he knows the danger of overcoaching from parents who mean well but intervene too much.
Exactly.
Talking about Daniel, who's recently become a father, which makes you the fact that recently you've become a grandfather, so we congratulate you on that again. Daniel must be thinking, oh, I'm missing out on this 470 World Championship that's about to kick off in Portugal. And I'd be keen if anyone wants to come in on this. I see we've got some people involved in the 470, both currently. So I'm thinking Iran and Israel, if you want to come in and discuss this. But also I see Nick Asher, former double 470 world champion, is here as well. How do you see, for those that are going, what's the best use they can make of this regatta? And for those that aren't going, like Daniel, how do they rationalize the fact that they're not going when there's so little regatta experience to be had?
Let's see if anyone comes in.
All right. Well, Iran, you'd be very welcome to come in if you would like to. Let's see if Iran can come in. Yes, looks like you might be able to.
Hello, but you see us?
Yes, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. So, I mean, Eli just came up, but Eli, also a former 470 sailor. We are here in Vila Mora.
Right.
For the Worlds, I'm coaching the mixed teams, the Israeli mixed teams.
And what's the feeling there? People must be feeling very fortunate to be at a regatta at all right now.
Yeah, it really, really seems like this. The last time they competed was like 1.5 years ago, something like that. Wasn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
So everybody just feeling blessed just to compete. And it's the world, so it's like really important regatta and with good atmosphere. I'm enjoying it too. Like so many years passed since I even seen a championship in the 470, so it's like really good.
So you competed at London 2012 for Israel. Yeah. Now you're working with the crews that are building up towards Marseille 2024, which is now a little more than 3 years away. So maybe the pressure is off them a little bit, but how do you think the male and the female teams aiming at Tokyo 2021, how do you think they're approaching this regatta?
I don't know, especially our teams bunch together with big differences between the two of them. Like one is really experienced and the other one is really, really like inexperienced. So we have big gaps, and all the sessions, the practices, the things we need to work on are most on one of them. Two of the crews are in two of the teams is the crew that is like younger and inexperienced. So it's all the training session are focusing more about one person in the team rather than regular training that you like training the team. So it's, I find it like really different. And they are like being motivated. For sure, it's combined with the COVID and the fact that they haven't sailed for a long time, but they feel like really motivated, and it's like a new class, even though they know the boat.
Aaron, Hamish, anything you want to say before we move on?
Oh, it's great to hear a regatta going ahead. I feel really envious of everybody in the family over there, and enjoy. Pass on my regards. And yeah, I mean, it's easy to look back on life and seen we've kind of took it for granted, this, you know, these opportunities to get together and enjoy each other's company and race each other. So yeah, COVID's definitely woken us up to that. And yeah, so I think everybody at that regatta is going to be enjoying it a huge amount.
Aaron, we wish you the best, and your sailors that you're coaching have a fantastic time at those Worlds. And yeah, like Hamish, the rest of us are all very envious as well. And Hamish, I don't know if you've spoken to Daniel about it. He's going to the Games in Tokyo 2021, but it won't be with the experience of doing this year's World Championships. So if he has asked you, well, you don't have to tell us what advice you would give, but... what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think they've done a really, really good job of staying motivated, and that's been the hardest thing with all the uncertainty. And it seems now like there's less uncertainty, that they've sort of got it, they're hatching a plan to have the Games go ahead, and they're you know, there's probably more than I've felt before, a lot more certainty about it. It's going to be a really different Games, but I think. Over here in New Zealand, we've taken the approach where, you know, we've really gone with a sort of a road to gold style approach, you know, where we're looking at across all the chapters where we can improve. We really embrace the mental skills thing, which the whole team has, you know, because it's one of those that you often gets left on the table and not attended to. You know, rules is another one. And there's lots of areas where we all know that we can improve, but we haven't prioritized it, you know, so we've gotten those things done, and the guys have done a really good job of just developing, because developing equipment is very motivational when you've got the right time and the right atmosphere to do it. And they've got a great training partner, an X470 world champion, and a really good young crew who is super motivated to be involved longer term with that guy. So, you know, and they've got some really good help from the outside, you know, so they're buzzing along. It's been a good 6 months for them.
Great. Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how the whole world comes together, not really knowing how you're going to be checking in against your competition. Obviously for the 470 sailors and the RSX sailors that are due to compete in Villamora this week, that will be a good opportunity for them to gauge their progress. But this is a fascinating experiment that COVID has delivered to us all. How do we make the best of our time when we're not able to compete? And we hope that Road to Gold, for the Olympians that have taken part in this, that's helped them keep their head in the game. What Santiago Langer and also Tom Burnham, the America's Cup coach, mentioned last week. Got a question here. Actually, I've also got a question from Keith Richardson as well. And Keith, you're asking one of Hamish's favourite questions here. Are there any advantages to the skipper and crew swapping positions to understand the other's role better? Well, for those that have been through the Road to Gold, they certainly know the answer to that. But for Keith, what is the answer, Hamish?
Yeah, well, it is a favourite question. And I was thinking of bringing it up when we talked about the sort of imbalance there with the Israeli team. So it's a really good way to completely understand each other's roles. And then from that position, you're able to sort of back each other up a lot more, and understanding when it's a, when one person has a lot on and the other person has got a little bit more space in their lives to help out a bit. So I think that that real understanding often ends up bringing the bar up higher. In my view, it always does.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that question, Keith. We love that one. And yeah. Two sailors that really should swap around more often in their 505 are Penny and Russ Clark, our hosts for the evening. And now you're asking a question on behalf of two friends of mine out in Australia, Heather and Chris McFarland. Penny and or Russ, would you like to come in and ask that question on their behalf?
Yeah, hi Andy. Chris and Heather are both following this road to gold. Unfortunately, they can't come on the calls because of the time difference. But we were chatting to them the other day about the course, and Heather had a really good question about your 10 traits of the ideal sailor. They're pretty small and they do a really good job of showing us a clean sheet of their transom in the light winds. And they just wondered what your take really was on that requirement for natural talent in light winds. Because given that they're quite small generally for the boats they've sailed, they actually felt that a natural talent in strong winds was really important. So wondered if you could give a bit more detail as to why you think the light winds in particular stands out.
That's a really good question. Yeah, I've just always assumed that probably because it's been easy for me to sail in strong winds. Now that you've kind of asked me that question, it suddenly dawned on me that, you know, it would be partially that reason, I think. But, you know, I remember thinking, you know, there's been other sailors I've noticed that you can go and drill and train and, you know, if you've got like a zero talent sort of base, you can actually go out and just, you know, hammer your boat handling in strong winds and get good enough to sail around the course when others can't. And it's purely a result of hard work and training. Whereas if you take the same set of guidelines and put them on the light air course with and drill and train to the same extent, everybody in the fleet can sail in light air. So you don't have that limitation of boat handling and maneuvering. So I guess that's more what I meant to clarify the answer I gave. I think it's you can take somebody who's got less talent and just drill and train them and get them good enough to go around the course in strong winds, which will give them a result that, you know, maybe 2/3 of the sailors won't get because they haven't done that. Whereas if you go to a light air, well, the whole fleet's able to get their boat around the course. So you've got a more challenging situation and it comes down to your skills. And maybe that's a little bit, you know, we often talked on the road to gold about where you've come from. And if you've come from a North American, Southern European place, you're likely to be pretty good in light air because you've always sailed in light air. And so it's, you've done your, you know, if you've done 10,000 hours, kind of the magic number, then it's likely that most of them were going to be in light air and you're really good at it. So I think it's largely a part of both.
Well, it is an interesting one. And I'm pleased that Heather and Chris brought up that question because the same thing was going through my mind, actually, as I was going back through putting the Road to Gold videos together. And I didn't get a chance to ask you about it myself, Hamish. But I wonder if one of the other reasons is when you make a mistake in strong winds, the boat screams at you. And when you make a mistake in light winds, it's only whispering at you. And it also brings to mind what Ian Percy said at the end of the 2004 games in Athens when he finished sixth, having gone there expecting to win a medal, and Torben Grail just ran away with it. And Ian said, Torben sees wind that nobody else sees. He just had that sixth sense, or Ian put it down to a sixth sense, which maybe is what we do as a sort of a get out of jail card for ourselves when we just can't work out how to solve a problem. We just say, oh, they've got a sixth sense. You know Torben really well, and you're pretty convinced, Hamish, that Yes, it is a talent, but also it is sailing in sea breezes as long as he has done, to start to see patterns in behavior of the wind that for most of us, it just looks like magic when someone works it out.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And, you know, sea breeze venues like Rio, and most of his sailing is exactly that. And it's just that 10,000 hours in the background there. He's probably done 8 of them in that light here. And then, you know, gotten incredibly skilled at it, and maybe a very natural sailor. You watch at a junior level, you can look at a fleet of Opties and you can see, you know, when somebody has got that instant ability to sort of sense where the wind's coming from, and they, you know, that little bubble we're looking for on the luff is always just perfectly aligned with the wind in the front of their sail. And you watch other people and you try to explain what they need to be doing to sail the boat upwind, and they're reaching backwards and forwards. And, you know, as those watching those sailors progress, you can see that as a hole that keeps on showing up. It's not something that it's just, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's talent versus, you know, nurture versus nature. And I don't know, you know, there's no one right answer or wrong answer. But if I was a coach, I'd kind of rather be helping a light air performer get better at a breeze than trying to help a, you know, really good heavy air performer, like say Ian Percy, get better at Torben Grail and light air, you know. It would be a shorter road, the first one.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Now, Harry, you've got a really interesting question. I just want to see if you will come in and ask this question yourself. Otherwise, I can ask it for you. So here you are, Harry.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to meet you guys. I'm a senior in high school, and I unfortunately haven't been able to get through the program very much because I'm very busy with schoolwork. But, you know, I've been sailing for a while. Unfortunately, I have very big goals for what I want to do in my sailing, but I haven't been able to be very consistent in terms of my training. So I'm wondering, and because of that, I've become, you know, somewhat unconfident in general in if I, you know, am even possible, if it's even possible for me to get to where I want to be. So I'm wondering what would you say for someone who's kind of discouraged from, you know, bad results and things like that. Yeah.
No, thanks for that question. I think it is really hard, you know, like the climbing the road, you know, in any sport, there's a hell of a lot of knocks on the way. I think, you know, getting expectations right is a really important part of it. I think that, you know, the real key thing to staying motivated is having the right expectations along the way, and also just making sure it's fun and enjoyable. If you get those two things right and your sort of foundations are well set in that area, you will keep building off those well, you know, nicely. Whereas if you have, you know, real lofty goals and high expectations without, you know, being able to, as you say, put the work in behind them to really build the foundation, then there'll be frustration and you know, that can be quite destructive. So it's really just a balance. And I think if you always come back to those sort of strong messages of expectations based on what you can do, you know, so if you know, you can do 10 hours a week, you know, put 10 hours a week towards your goal in sailing, then those expectations can rise to this level. But if your goal's, you know, 1 or 2 hours a week, you've got to lower your expectations. So it's just, yeah, try to keep it fun all the time and get what you can out of it and really search for what it is you're looking for.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Harry, can you just tell us what is your dream goal? What would you like to be able to achieve?
So I'm just absolutely obsessed with sailing. I don't know if you guys know about Oak Cliff in the U.S.
Dawn Riley's place.
Yeah. So I train there a lot. I've also been in some high school circuits, but unfortunately, I haven't been able to really stick it in with them, and my results have always been pretty terrible, to be honest. In that, in 420s and lasers and stuff like that. And with COVID, it kind of shut everything down again. And now I'm just hoping to get into college sailing where I can really start to be consistent and work as hard as possible in that. So, yeah.
Nice.
And so, yeah, what do you feel that you might be able to achieve if you get your ducks in a row and you manage
I didn't really answer the question. Yeah, so I'm just hoping for the America's Cup, honestly. And I mean, my biggest lofty goals are America's Cup and Volvo Ocean Race. So, yeah.
Yeah,
so definitely what I kind of fall back on is a lot of kids that are doing high school sailing in the US have, you know, zero experience in offshore sailing. And that's the thing I work on a lot at Oak Cliff. So that's kind of one area where I'm confident. But then in my dinghy sailing, it's, you know, I have a lot of issues understanding the puffs and connecting the dots really on the race course, which I think just stems from not having as much experience. But yeah.
Nice. Oh, well, that's good. You know, like I mean, you really want to take a look at the profile of those sailors in the game you're trying to play. And that's, you know, that's a really good place to start, you know, and you probably have a good feel for that with Dawn and her program. And then there's obviously that Olympic offshore program now as well, which will be, you know, probably a bit of a stepping stone into that world you want to go to.
Right. Yeah.
Hamish, one of the things that we mention, you talk about the longer that you spend away from small boats, the more you deteriorate as a sailor, that you lose that feel. You feel very strongly that the smaller the boat or the craft, if we're talking about a board or a foiler or something, the more in tune you have to be as that feel kind of sailor. And it's interesting to see how 49er sailors have done particularly well in moving into the Volvo Ocean Race when the boats got a lot faster with the Volvo Open 70. They seem to be the sailors in demand, and moth sailors seem to be well tuned in to what's required for sailing an AC 75 in the America's Cup. So do you have any advice to Harry that even though his goals are aimed at the big boats like the America's Cup and the Volvo Ocean Race, where he should be honing his skills?
I think you've got to get noticed. So, you know, focusing on an event that you can perform well at, and the college sailing, I know in America's produced some amazingly good sailors in the past who have gone on to do incredible things. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to start. You know, you get yourself noticed there, and then, you know, within any of these teams, it's about being in the right sort of physical build and in the right place at the right time. And they're real team sports, so they're looking for people who can get on within the group. And, you know, I know there's an age factor which forces these teams to take a certain amount of younger people, a certain amount of gender equity. So there's always that early ticket as well while you're young, if you can get into that right profile. But I wish you all the best. You just, you know, people with dreams, strong dreams, strong goals, you know, it's amazing how many of them make it a reality. So go for it.
Thank you. I mean, sorry, I don't want to take up more time. My worry is, you know, getting noticed in general. Like, I have no real idea of how do you just get a call one day, like, oh, hey, you want to try out for a team? But so if I don't have any good results, you know, there's no way really to get noticed for a team. Even if I could get on, I know for a fact that I would be able to work insanely hard and, you know, make my place worth it. But yeah.
Well, Hamish has done it. He did it the hard way in that he got successful very early, winning his first 470 world title at the age of 19. That's one way to get noticed. But Harry, I think the other way to get noticed is just to keep on showing up on the dock. And one day you'll be in the right place at the right time. Somebody else is ill. Somebody else just didn't show up for whatever reason. And if you're there in the right place at the right time, that can often end up being the key moment that opens doors. And I think about times when I ruled myself out of trying out for something because I didn't think I'd be good enough. And I really look back on those moments and regret not seizing those opportunities, thinking I'd already written myself off before I'd even done the interview. And once you've started doing a job, whether it's doing bow or pit or whatever it is on a big boat, once you've done it a few times and you're not faking anymore, you actually know which way to put the rope on the winch, then you do start to... You become part of the furniture. And so I just think always put your hand up for every opportunity. And you've shown that by sticking your hand up here and asking a very personal question, you know, you're telling us that you're not very confident. But I mean, if you're confident enough to ask a question and be brave enough to put yourself out here in this kind of forum where we are right now, if you can take that same kind of attitude to every time you try and get yourself onto a sailing campaign, I think you'll get there.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, as Fylde, I wish I knew Fylde's the rest of his name, but you've only failed when you give up. Absolutely. So thank you for that question. I think it's a fantastic question, Harry. Hamish, we're just about on time at the moment. Do you have any more time or do you need to get going?
Probably get going, but I was just going to leave it with, we were talking about what's going to happen, you know, when everybody gets together again after this COVID period where we've been away training in each corner of the world and doing what we can. And I think it's going to be fascinating. We're going to see some you know, unexpected things as a result of it. You know, we could suddenly see someone lightning fast in the 49er and not have noticed them before. They've gone away with a really good little group, training group in some little corner of the world and really made a jump. And I think almost I feel more afraid of what to expect at the Olympics and the 49er with Peter and Blair than I would have if it had just been the normal regular racing program, which only allows, you know, you can see where people are coming and where they're going to. But in this situation, the unexpected could happen. So I think it's a really exciting period. And I think of the America's Cup, you know, just to finish up on, you know, remember Team New Zealand in Bermuda was shut away in Auckland here doing all their training sort of by themselves because they couldn't afford to go to Bermuda where all the other teams were. And they didn't arrive in Bermuda until really, really late before the last America's Cup. And they suddenly rocked up with everybody cycling rather than grinding and a whole lot of new things that they'd developed in their own little world, in their own space. And remember, against no other opposition. So they were just sailing themselves or sailing the coach boat or sailing their targets and the you know, VPP targets. So, and then they went and won the America's Cup with better speed and better boat handling and in the end, a better race trade. But when they started off, their race trade was shocking. They hardly could get off the line and race well. So, you know, I expect that we're in an exciting phase. We're going to see new developments.
Yeah, new developments makes me think of that photo that you sent me the other day of a code zero on Emirates Team New Zealand. Now, you didn't send me any comment in relation to that. I don't know if you made that up in Photoshop or no. Obviously, I mean we've seen them being used, but the way that we've seen the challengers racing, it's hard to imagine that a code zero is really going to get used in the America's Cup. Hamish, tell us now, but let us be the first to know.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in the game have probably guessed it's it's there for one of those days where the wind drops, and you've started the race, and you know you're ripping along on your foils, and then suddenly, you know, you're not, and the breeze is below the wind limits, but the race has started, so it's got to finish. The time limits for the first leg is 12 minutes, and then the time limit for the race, as we've seen with our race against Ineos, is 45 minutes. And so they have the ability to shorten it down to four legs, but at the end of the day, you are you've got to get across the finishing line, and I think we missed the finishing line by what, a minute and a half that day. We just needed a little bit more horsepower.
Right, there you have it. Well, that makes absolute sense now you explain that, which is why, of course, you have to dig into the rules in great depth to understand why people might make a sale that may never even get used. So Hamish, thank you very much for that. Let's hope that the America's Cup does get going this Wednesday. This was an extra session that we added on to the 12 Q&A. So this was Q&A number 13. Thank you so much to all our regulars that showed up. And thank you for those of you that turned up for the first time just to listen in and get a sense of what the Road to Gold was like. I hope it wasn't too overwhelming. I hope you get to understand why people have enjoyed the journey as much as they have. And I mean, Hamish, we planned this out, but a lot of it we're sort of making up as we go along as well, because we didn't know what was going to happen with Road to Gold and until we put it out there. So there aren't any more promises currently of doing any more Q&As. So I'm not going to say anything right now, but it would be useful if you can send us an email and just let us know what kind of appetite there is for continuing the Q&As. And if you think it would be valuable for us to maintain those. And once the America's Cup is passed, Hamish then gets to find out what he's going to be doing with Pete and Blair. Hopefully, I mean, Hamish, when do you think we're going to know? When do you think we'll have a definitive answer about whether Tokyo 2021 is going ahead? Because then you'll know what you're doing with your life.
I think they've got to answer that question by the end of March for sure. It's imminent. They can't leave it longer than that.
Right. So we could know within the next 4 weeks then, or less than that. So my reason for asking is the Road to Gold continues. We've launched version one. We're very happy with how it's been received, but we're keen for as much feedback as possible so that Hamish and I can scope out how we're going to take it forwards from here and continue to help you as much as we possibly can. Hamish, when we were talking with Penny and Russ before we got on the call with everybody else, they had a great question for you, which is what you've learned over the last number of weeks. So just give us your feedback on what you've learned, passing on all this information to everybody else.
Yeah, well it was an overwhelming thing to take on in the beginning. I think starting a project is always like I said to you, Andy, you know, it would never have gotten to its conclusion without your support and pushing it all the way through, you know. And I think, like you said, it was over 6 months ago when we made the decision to push it along. It's been a great journey. I've enjoyed it way more than I thought it would. And obviously a large part of that's just all the fantastic feedback we've been getting from everybody. I think that really helps to, you know, really make the whole thing worth doing, you know. So thank you to everyone.
Well, thank you, Hamish. Yes, originally this was going to be a book, but we decided to do an online course instead. And I'm so glad that we did, because we get this interactivity with you. And that's one of the most enjoyable aspects. In answer to Seb, go on, Hamish Beersport, can we see through the America's Cup, please? I can't give you that answer right now, Seb, but we'll see. Watch this space. So that's it for this evening. Thanks very much to everyone for watching. Thanks to Russ and Penny for stepping in and being our hosts behind the scenes. And thank you, Hamish. Good luck in the coming week for the Cup, and catch up with you soon.
Thank you. Cheers, guys.